Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Over 2 million deaths and $4.3 trillion in economic losses. That's the impact of a half century of extreme weather events turbocharged by man-made global warming, the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, said on Monday. According to the UN agency, weather, climate, and water-related hazards caused close to 12,000 disasters between 1970 and 2021. Developing countries were hit hardest, seeing 9 in 10 deaths and 60% of economic losses from climate shocks and extreme weather. WMO said that least developed countries and small island developing states suffered a disproportionately high cost in relation to the size of their economies. The UN agency stressed, however, that improved early warnings and coordinated disaster management save lives. Together with partners, WMO is working to ensure that every person on Earth is protected by early warning systems by the end of 2027. A first set of 30 countries have been identified for the rollout of the UN's Early Warnings for All initiative this year. This month's deadly floods in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, were the latest aggravating factor in the neglected humanitarian crisis affecting the country, the UN said on Monday. The floods killed over 400 people in DRC's South Kivu province, and as many as 6,000 are still missing. Bruno Le Marquis, the top UN aid official in the country, said that the humanitarian situation in the DRC had worsened since March 2022, with the resurgent rebel M23 movement forcing an additional 1 million people from their homes, driving total displacement up to more than 6.3 million. Most of the newly displaced now live in informal settlements in North Kivu province where they need shelter, food, water and sanitation, basically everything, Mr. Le Marquis said. Over 26 million people in the DRC are food insecure, humanitarian access is difficult and life-saving relief work is poorly funded. Here's Mr. Le Marquis with a call for support to the international community.
In 2023, we are looking at raising $2.25 billion for the year, and so far we are almost in June, we have only raised 20% of that amount. It's very important to increase the advocacy for the DRC and to increase the financing for that crisis. This situation is not business as usual. The bleeding needs to stop.
Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, ZNPP, lost all external power and was forced to run on emergency diesel generators once again, the UN's nuclear watchdog IAEA said on Monday. This is the seventh time that the ZNPP, which is Europe's largest nuclear power plant, has lost its external power supply since Russia's full-scale invasion of the country. In a tweet, IAEA chief Rafael Grossi called the nuclear safety situation at the plant extremely vulnerable and said that we must agree to protect the plant now. This situation cannot continue. IAEA experts are deployed at the Russian-occupied ZNPP, which is still being run by Ukrainian civilians and has repeatedly been shelled during the war. In the latest incident, a location close to the nearby town of Enerhodar, home to most of the ZNPP staff, came under artillery fire on Friday. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Log Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio for Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County.
Good afternoon, friends and listeners. It's a beautiful day today here in Northeast Kansas. We had an incredible 76 degrees, very little wind, and no rain. We've had a great couple of days since I was last with you, last Friday. And the weather has been outstanding, perfect for outside work in the yard or, you know, carpentry, things like that. garage work, leave the door open. Lots of good stuff coming up. And as usual, John Grant comes in the second hour. Let's see if we can, I think I got it. Yes, I think I do. I have this morning's Democracy Now, right now. Here we go.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy emerged from the White House Monday without a deal to raise the limit on the national debt. McCarthy's high-stakes negotiations with President Biden came just 10 days before the U.S. faces a possible default on loans, with Republicans demanding sweeping cuts to social programs as the price of any deal to raise the U.S. debt ceiling. After the talks, McCarthy shrugged off a reporter's question about whether Republicans would support rescinding the Trump-era tax cuts that overwhelmingly favor corporations and wealthy U.S. residents.
So the problem is not revenue, the problem is spending. I simply believe, like any household, like any business, like any state government, when you're this far out of whack, you have to spend less than you spent last year.
Earlier this month, the Congressional Budget Office reported extending tax cuts passed in 2017 and signed by then-President Trump would add $3.5 trillion to the federal deficit through 2033. This is House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
They've taken revenues off the table. They don't want to revisit the GOP tax scam, which exploded the debt by $2 trillion to subsidize the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected. They said, no, we can't have a conversation about that. Can't have a conversation about revenue. Can't have a conversation about any policy changes that Democrats would like to have. Does that sound like a negotiation? Or is that a hostage-taking situation?
House Democratic Leader Jeffries said he's open to a deal that would see federal spending frozen at current levels. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus have rejected that idea. They're calling on President Biden to invoke his authority to avert a debt default under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Russia's war in Ukraine spilled back into Russian territory Monday as self-described anti-Kremlin Russian militias launched cross-border raids into the Belgorod region of southwestern Russia. Groups calling themselves the Russian Volunteer Corps and the Freedom of Russia Legion claim to have captured the Russian border town of Kozinka and several others. This is an unnamed fighter with the group in a video released Monday.
We are Russians just like you. We are people just like you. We want our children to grow up in peace and be free people so that they can travel, study, and just be happy in a free country. But this has no place in today's Putin's Russia. Rotten from corruption, lies, censorship, restrictions on freedoms, repressions.
In a statement, Russian officials said they'd opened a terrorism investigation against anti-Kremlin militia fighters in Belgorod. Meanwhile, a recent UN report accuses mercenaries from Russia's Wagner group of involvement in a March 2022 massacre in a village in Mali in Africa, which killed at least 500 people. Most of those are believed to be civilians rather than Islamist militants, as claimed by authorities. The report also says the attack by Malian troops and Wagner in Moura included rapes and torture. Wagner mercenaries operate in Mali and at least six other African nations, where they've been accused of atrocities, while the U.S. has said Wagner is trafficking natural resources from African nations to fund the invasion of Ukraine. India's meteorological department has issued heat alerts for the capital, New Delhi, and several states as daytime temperatures soar to 45 degrees Celsius, or more than 113 degrees Fahrenheit. Parts of the northern state of Uttar Pradesh have suffered blackouts of more than 12 hours, coming despite a government order that all power plants run at full capacity. In Alberta, Canada, forecasters say rain and cooling temperatures should help firefighters bring a record-smashing spring wildfire season under control after some 2.3 million acres burned. Smoke from the fires has prompted air quality alerts in U.S. states including Colorado, Idaho, Montana, and Utah. On Monday, the World Meteorological Organization reported extreme weather events caused some 2 million deaths since 1970, with over 90% of those killed from the global south. The Biden administration has reached a three-year deal with Western states to conserve water from the Colorado River. Under the agreement, the federal government will distribute $1.2 billion to water districts and tribes in California, Arizona, and Nevada to compensate them for cutting back their water use. The plan hopes to slash water use from the Colorado River by 13%. 30 years of drought fueled by the climate crisis have reduced the river's natural flow by about 20%. Conservationists welcome the agreement but said a more permanent solution is needed to protect both the river and the 40 million people who rely on it for agriculture, drinking water, and electricity. Nevada lawmakers have approved a measure that would protect people from out of state who travel to Nevada seeking an abortion from prosecution. The bill now heads to Republican Governor Joe Lombardo's desk. Lombardo's office said he hadn't yet decided if he would sign it into law. In related news, eight more women have joined a lawsuit against Texas's near-total abortion ban, arguing the restrictions put their health and lives at risk as they were forced to carry out pregnancies despite experiencing medical emergencies. Five other women had initially filed the lawsuit in March. South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott has entered the race for his party's 2024 presidential nomination. Scott officially announced his candidacy Monday at a campaign rally in North Charleston.
Joe Biden and the radical left are attacking every single rung of the ladder that helped me climb. And that's why I'm announcing today that I'm running for president of the United States of America.
South Carolina Senator Scott is the 11th black senator in U.S. history and only the second African-American Republican senator since Reconstruction in the 1860s and 70s. He has an A rating from anti-abortion and pro-gun groups. The writer E. Jean Carroll seeking further damages in a defamation lawsuit against Donald Trump after he mocked her in a May 10th televised town hall event broadcast live on CNN while an audience packed with Trump supporters laughed and applauded his remarks. Carroll seeking at least $10 million in additional compensation. Earlier this month, a New York jury in a separate lawsuit found Trump liable for sexually abusing her at the Bergdorf Goodman department store in the 1990s and defaming her, ordering Trump to pay $5 million. Meanwhile, federal prosecutors led by special counsel Jack Smith have filed a subpoena seeking information about the Trump Organization's deals in seven countries since 2017. The probe suggests Smith is looking into possible connections between Trump's foreign business dealings and classified documents taken to Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort after he left office. The U.S. Secret Service has detained the driver of a rental truck that crashed into security barriers outside the White House Monday night. No one was injured in the ramming. Investigators found a Nazi swastika flag in the truck and say the driver hit the barriers at least twice in an apparently deliberate attack. In Arizona, the FBI has launched an investigation into the fatal shooting of the respected Tohono O'odham artist and leader Raymond Mattia, who was gunned down by Border Patrol agents outside his home last Thursday. Mattia lived in the community of Menetir's Dam, just a few miles from the U.S.-Mexico border. He'd called Border Patrol after finding a group of migrants on his property. Mattia's family says he went outside when the agents arrived and that he was about 2 feet from his front door when they heard gunshots. His relatives are demanding justice as authorities have released few details into what happened. This comes as more details have emerged on the death of an 8-year-old migrant girl from Panama in the custody of Customs and Border Protection last week. Anadith Tane Reyes Alvarez suffered from a congenital heart condition and sickle cell anemia, according to her family. Reyes, her parents, and siblings were detained in Texas for over a week. While in custody, Reyes became sick with influenza. She later appeared to have a seizure and had difficulties breathing. It wasn't until her body went limp and she began bleeding from the mouth that border agents took her to a local hospital, where the girl was pronounced dead less than an hour after arriving. Her mother, Mabel Alvarez, told the New York Daily News, quote, "She cried and begged for her life and they ignored her. They didn't do anything for her," she said. In Georgia, the gruesome death of LaShawn Thompson, a 35-year-old black man in the Fulton County Jail last year, has been ruled a homicide due to severe neglect. The findings of the independent autopsy were released Monday by Thompson's family and civil rights attorney Ben Crump. Thompson was being held in the jail's psychiatric wing, where his family says he was eaten alive by insects and bed bugs in his cell. The report found the lack of medical treatment for Thompson's schizophrenia, as well as dehydration, malnutrition, rapid weight loss, and, quote, severe body insect infestation, all contributed to his death. Thompson's independent autopsy, which was funded by former NFL star Colin Kaepernick, came after the Fulton County Medical Examiner ruled his cause of death was undetermined. In Hollywood, members of the SAG-AFTRA Actors Union have set a June 5th deadline for 160,000 members to cast ballots in a strike authorization vote. In recent days, actors have joined Hollywood writers on picket lines after some 11,500 members of the Writers Guild of America went on strike May 2nd to demand livable wages as corporate profits soar. On Sunday, students at Boston University graduation ceremony booed and chanted, "Pay your writers," as Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav delivered the commencement address.
If you want to be successful, you're going to have to figure out how to get along with everyone. And that includes difficult people.
Dozens of transgender children and youth from across the country gathered in Washington, D.C. Monday for a prom celebrating trans lives. The prom was held on the National Mall near the Capitol as anti-LGBTQ attacks intensify nationwide. This is trans activist Chase Strangio, a staff attorney at the ACLU, one of the organizers of the action.
These young people are here with the families and trans adults who love and care for them. Today, we are choosing to build upon the legacies of our ancestors, embracing the possibilities of our futures, and refocusing our collective imagination on the freedom, beauty, and joy that we represent. Our joy is ours. You may not see it. You may not think it exists. You may try to take it away, but it is ours. And today and every day, we celebrate, cultivate, and embrace it.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. I made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two. See some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running. For red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while, but I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
And you can check it out now, ecoshock.org, or tomorrow. Tomorrow, that's right, Wednesday, first thing at noon, EcoShock. The latest EcoShock comes out, hosted by Alex Smith, followed by TUC Radio. And now, the latest radio magazine from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org. The radio magazine hosted by Janine Jackson, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, do you care about environmental degradation? Then you care about Cup City. Do you care about the violent over-policing of black and brown communities? Then you care about Cup City. Do you care about purportedly democratic governance that overrides the actual voice of the people? Well, then you care about Cup City. But be aware, your concern about Cup City and its myriad impacts and implications may get you labeled a domestic terrorist. The official response to popular resistance to the militarized policing facility being created on top of the forest in Atlanta, Georgia, is an exemplar of how some officials intend to bring all powers to which they have access, and even to create new powers, to treat anyone that stands in opposition to whatever they decide to do as enemies of the state, deserving life-destroying prison sentences. So if your thoughts about Cop City don't motivate you, think about your right to protest anything at all. We'll talk about anti-activist terrorism charges with Cody Bloomfield, Communications Director at Defending Rights and Dissent. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. For much of this year, widespread protests have engulfed Israel in response to the Netanyahu government's attempts to overhaul the state's judiciary. Corporate media in the U.S. present this situation as a crisis of democracy. As Greg Shupak reports for FAIR.org, since the demonstrations began in January, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post have run a combined total of 194 pieces that contain some variant of the words Israel, crisis, and democracy. Just 77, or less than 40% of those, include reference to Palestine or Palestinians. That shortage is meaningful, given that the Israeli government controls the lives of approximately 14 million people, half of them Jewish and half of them Palestinian. These include 2.6 million Palestinians living in the West Bank under Israeli military occupation and without political rights, 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, where Israel prevents them from enacting their political rights and confines them to an open-air prison, and a further 350,000 Palestinians living in eastern Jerusalem, which was illegally annexed by Israel in 1967, who nevertheless do not have the right to vote in Israel's national elections. And then roughly 1.9 million Palestinians living on the land that Israel has controlled since 1948 do have Israeli citizenship and can vote in elections, but discrimination against them is still enshrined in law. In other words, of the 7 million Palestinians over whom Israel exercises authority, approximately 5 million have no say in who governs them or how, while Israel relegates the remaining 2 million to second-class citizenship. So when Tom Friedman at The Times talks about ensuring that, quote, the 75th anniversary of Israeli democracy will not be its last, close quote, or the Post Jennifer Rubin says that Israel's protests underscore the importance of persuading, quote, citizens to put loyalty to democracy above loyalty to party or institutions, close quote, or emphatically, when the Journal's editorial board suggests that the demonstrations prove that, quote, Israeli democracy is alive and well, close quote, well, these are less accurate than propagandistic descriptions. The Washington Post ran an op-ed by Gershom Gorenberg warning that Netanyahu and his henchmen might follow the weakening of the courts with, quote, laws harming the rights of women, the Arab minority, LGBTQ citizens, and the press, close quote. And while Shupak notes Netanyahu's gambit could indeed make life even worse for Palestinians, they would be that Arab minority referred to, while Israel currently has 65 laws that explicitly discriminate against Palestinians on the basis of their national belonging, it's dishonest to present laws harming the rights of Palestinians as a hypothetical possibility rather than a defining feature of Israel's past and present. In other words, the crisis of Israel's democracy is that it's not a democracy at all. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Resistance to the militarized police training complex known as Cop City has been happening since its inception, when Georgia authorities overruled community opinion to create the facility, being built on Atlanta's South River Forest in the wake of the 2020 Black Lives Matter actions, that includes an area for explosives training and a whole mock city for cops to practice suppressing urban protest. In January, police killed the environmental activist known as Tortuguita in a hail of bullets while, as they, an autopsy revealed, sat cross-legged with their hands up. The medical examiner ruled it homicide. There isn't more you can do to someone protesting your actions than kill them, but authorities are trying to ruin the lives of many others with domestic terrorism charges that call for many years in prison. The state actors behind Cop City, if you somehow can't see it, are engaging in the overt employment of the very overreaching, harmful powers activists are concerned the facility will foment. Cody Bloomfield is Communications Director at Defending Rights and Dissent. They join us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Cody Bloomfield.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm dismayed by what's happening in Cop City, but always appreciate the opportunity to bring this news to more folks.
Absolutely. Well, Atlanta organizer Kamel Franklin told Counterspin a few weeks back that the land that Cop City is going to be on was promised to the adjacent community, which is 70% black, as a park area, you know, and there was going to be nature trails and hiking. And then when the idea of Cop City arose from the Atlanta Police Department, the City of Atlanta, and the Atlanta Police Foundation, all of those plans were scrapped immediately without any input from that adjoining community, and they went forward with this idea. Just to say, people didn't suddenly start protesting Cop City recently, and they didn't do it because they saw something on social media. This project has been over and against the community and the environment, not that they're separate, since the beginning. So just to say, the context for the bringing of these charges of domestic terrorism against activists, it's not that activists are suddenly engaged in something new and especially dangerous that is calling for this response.
Yeah, so the occupation of Cop City has been going on for over a year. And we see from the very outset that there has been police resistance to these protests. Very early on, back in 2021, activists told me that during the pandemic, they couldn't show up in person to city council meetings because all of the meetings were being held remotely. And so they decided to do a banner action outside of one of the city council members' homes during the decision to approve Cop City. They dropped the banner outside of someone's house, and then they were arrested by police, and they were hauled to jail for the crime of being a pedestrian in the roadway. This was all the way back in 2021, and then people started camping in the forest, also way back in 2021. And the first arrest for domestic terrorism didn't happen until December 2022. And at that point, people were being arrested for just using the forest. Like in December, there were reports that someone had been arrested who was just going on a hike, who wasn't part of the occupation. But in December was when the police crackdown began in earnest, and the people who had been camping for months were arrested. Things like sleeping in a hammock with another defendant was used as evidence, as was First Amendment protected activity, including being a member of a prison abolition movement. And that's when the escalated stage of repression really began. And this repression accelerated in January, when police again stormed the encampment and murdered Tortuguita and issued more domestic terrorism arrest warrants. Then there were the subsequent protests over the killing of Tortuguita in Atlanta, and still more people were charged with domestic terrorism. And all that was the lead-up mobilization that the activists called for the first week of March, in which many people came from out of state and around the world to protest. But what a lot of the media has been missing is they focused on the week of action and saw in the list of arrestees many people from out of state. They're missing that this out-of-state solidarity was just a tip on the iceberg of months and years of local organizing.
Right. And I bring it up in part to say that I think that folks who are distanced from it might fall to that line of, if only folks would protest in the right way, you know, without breaking anything. And so it's important to understand that even when folks did things like banner drops and petition drives, they already were being abused and harassed for that style of protest. But domestic terrorism, that's deep. That's serious. How loose are the rules for applying these charges? This is talking about perhaps 20 years in prison for people. This has to be, there have to be some legal definitions around the charge of domestic terrorism, don't there?
Yes, and it's really interesting, actually. Some states don't even have domestic terrorism statutes, because most crimes that you could prosecute as domestic terrorism, you could also prosecute under existing statutes. Like, the Georgia law was passed in response to Dylann Roof's massacre of a black church. But they could have decided at that juncture to prosecute mass murder and prosecute these murders independent of the statute. But they decided that for subsequent events like this, they wanted the domestic terrorism statute. And they passed a very broad statute. The Georgia statute defines domestic terrorism as something that endangers critical infrastructure. And this critical infrastructure can be publicly or privately owned. It can be a state or government facility. And as long as someone's acting with the intent to change or coerce the policy of government, that can count as domestic terrorism. Now, this statute stands out from the national landscape of domestic terrorism statutes. Again, some states don't even have them, and they seem to be doing fine. And in most other states that have domestic terrorism statutes, the domestic terrorism statutes address things like weapons of mass destruction, or they at least require for someone to have died as a result of the alleged terrorism. The Georgia statute doesn't. And you might notice in the part about altering or changing the policy of government, that's precisely what a lot of protest is intended to do.
Right.
And protest intended to change the policy of government that happens to take place in conjunction with critical infrastructure, which they've been arguing that Cop City is, opens up activists for being charged with domestic terrorism. Now, this is a very serious statute. It has a mandatory minimum of 5 years in prison, going all the way up to a maximum of 35 years in prison. So that alone might be enough to dissuade some activists from showing up to protest. And it's worth pointing out here that among the people charged with domestic terrorism during the March Week of Action, some people say that they were only going to attend a music festival, which would have been at most misdemeanor trespassing. But when people came back from a march in which they'd burned bulldozers, which is defined as critical infrastructure necessary to build Cop City, they went into the crowd. Police started making arrests at random. And so some people who, by all accounts, were not involved in burning the bulldozers, who'd simply showed up for Stop Cop City solidarity actions for the music festival, were charged with extremely serious statutes, and then most were held in jail for over a month. And so then their whole lives were disrupted. They were faced with this intimidating statute that'll take a lot of money and a lot of time to fight, all to dissuade people from becoming activists. And we worry a lot about the chilling effect around these sorts of things in the civil liberties community. And it's often something we talk about in very hypothetical terms. But around this was a rare instance where I saw the chilling effect in practice. There was a group that reached out to me about possibly going down to protest, and I felt like I had to give the heads up that these domestic terrorism arrests are happening somewhat at random, and the activists ultimately decided not to go down. They decided the risk of protesting was simply too high, and that's what charging domestic terrorism is intended to do. It's intended to make the risk of protesting too high so that people will just stay home, so that people will stay quiet.
Absolutely. And, you know, we should note that the harms don't necessarily have to come from law enforcement or in the form of prison. We have seen people coming back from protests being, for example, kicked out of school, you know. So this is something that's hovering over them, even if they don't wind up in prison.
Yeah. And recently we've heard reports of a loss of access to financial institutions for some of the defendants. So far, we've heard that Chase Bank, Bank of America, Venmo, and U.S. Bank have withheld access to banking for certain domestic terrorism defendants. Also, two people had Airbnb accounts closed. As you mentioned, there was the law student who's unable to return to school. So these charges, even though they have not seen their day in court, have not been proven in court, are already having detrimental effects on the activists.
Well, I want to bring you back to this outside agitator line, which ought to ring bells for lots of folks. I mean, to be clear, the public rejection of hyper-policing is being used as a reason for more hyper-policing. And then the fact that people are recognizing, well, this isn't just Atlanta, this isn't just Georgia, this is something, you know, that can come to me, that is itself being used as more reason. And your Truth Out piece cites the Atlanta Police Department's assistant chief saying, quote, none of those people live here, speaking of activists, none of those people live here. They do not have a vested interest in this property, and we show that time and time again. Why is an individual from Los Angeles, California, concerned about a training facility being built in the state of Georgia? And that is why we consider that domestic terrorism, close quote. What the actual heck there?
Yeah, it's an extremely striking quote, mostly because it's just a lie that any part of the statute depends on who's in-state versus out-of-state. And we look at the history of activism, and activists have always traveled to be where they're most needed. Throughout the civil rights movement, people frequently cross state lines. There was the whole Freedom Rider movement. And whenever there's international solidarity or national solidarity, we always see this narrative of outside agitators being used to discredit the entire movement. it's seen as nefarious outside actors driving the movement instead of solidarity that starts where the negative thing is happening and expands outward from there. It's an incredibly frustrating narrative, and it's frustrating to see people with state power repeat this narrative, especially when the actual charges have no relation to that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it hardly needs saying Cop City itself is not a wholly local enterprise, is it?
No. Cop City is designed to be a training facility for police across the country. And with the interconnected systems of policing, of intelligence gathering, we see that Cop City is an everywhere problem,
yeah.
And as is all policing. And to charge that only the people within a specific mile radius should have anything to say about it is absurd.
Well, part of this kind of repression of activity involves suppressing information, and that has involved the overt harassment of reporters, Truthout's Candace Byrne and others, for example, but it also involves suppressing information itself about what's going on. And I understand that you at Defending Rights and Dissent have been working on the transparency front of what's happening here.
Yeah, so we, from a FOIA release to Pilsen Books in Chicago, we know that, at least from the federal intelligence perspective, they're very much seeing the Stop Cop City movement as national. When some of the Defend the Atlanta Forest folks went on tour talking about resistance to Stop Cop City elsewhere, the FBI decided to spy on an anarchist bookstore that was holding the event, and they went through the social media of the event organizers, they went through the social media of the bookstore, and created intelligence files. And we think that that's just the tip of the iceberg. There hasn't been a lot of transparency around what sort of intelligence is being gathered on these activists. Given that they're charged with domestic terrorism, we expect that quite a lot of evidence has been acquired against them, much of it likely open source and First Amendment protected. The line in one of the arrest warrant affidavits about the defendant being a member of the prison abolitionist movement gives some hint that they're likely surveilling a lot of social media, but we don't know the full extent of surveillance that's happening here. And it's worth pointing out, as we talk about surveillance, that surveillance on its own can also be a form of repression, especially for vulnerable activists who might be worried about protesting as a person of color, who might be worried about having an existing FBI file. The prospect of being surveilled might alone dissuade them from engaging in activism, but we don't know the full landscape of that surveillance. So Defending Rights and Dissent, along with recently Project South, have filed a few rounds of Freedom of Information Act requests and open records requests targeted at looking at just how much the state is surveilling these activists and what kind of evidence and intelligence is being collected. And so far, we've just been stonewalled. They've only responded to one query, which was about the Atlanta Police Foundation. And they said, oh, it's like hundreds of thousands of emails. You need to refine your request. And then we refined our request and haven't heard from them since. So we anticipate having to litigate all these requests, which is ridiculous because under the federal statute, under the state statute, there's a dedicated amount of time in which they're supposed to give us this information. There's supposed to be that transparency, and there just hasn't been in this case.
Well, this is exactly where one would hope for the powers of journalism and independent journalism to move in, you know, to use their heft to get at some of these questions. And yet, in terms of larger corporate media, there's been a lot of terrific independent reporting on this, but larger corporate media, you know, I saw a piece by Eva Rosenfeld in the Indiana Herald Times in which she was talking just about the overacceptance of the police narrative on certain things, but also asking about big framing questions. Why are media not asking, for example, why is a $90 million investment intended to fight crime better spent building a mock city than investing in real communities? Too often we see, you know, big media zeroing in. Did this person actually break a window rather than pulling back and saying, wait a minute, is property more important than human beings? What is actually happening here? I'm wondering what you make of big media, if you will, approach to this story.
Yeah, every second that we spend in the media litigating about whether or not people should have burned down a bulldozer or whether or not people had the right to go camping is another moment we're not spending talking about the substantive issues here. And I think as soon as the domestic terrorism charges came down, the whole conversation became about whether or not the activists were domestic terrorists, which was, you know, a reasonable line of argument, but totally missed the story of an anti-democratic lack of accountability permeating throughout Cop City.
Right.
From when city council ignored 70% of public comments in opposition to Cop City to recently when they were charging other people with intimidation of an officer for handing out flyers, trying to do public education. This whole movement to build Cop City has been profoundly undemocratic, and we lose that when we spend time focusing on what crimes protesters may or may not have committed.
Personally, I want to say that I feel like, you know your rights is a very important thing, you know, for individuals to know what their rights are in given situations. And yet, it's not so satisfying to say, I know my rights and they're being violated right now. You know, we can't really individualize protest, which it seems like is so much the effort, you know, of those who oppose it to separate us and to say, do you, Janine Jackson, really want to show up at protest?
Yeah, and that's why, especially in fighting these prosecutions, movement solidarity will be so important. We saw after the January 20th protest against the inauguration of Trump and an attempt by prosecutors to engage in kind of conspiratorial thinking and to paint protesters with a broad brush. And protesters were really successful in trying to fight this as a bloc, in insisting on taking cases to trial where many of them were thrown out. Prosecutors gave up on a lot of the charges, and so that was a success of movement organizing. And I think here that we have to have that same sort of solidarity, because it doesn't do any good to know your rights. Like, you might know your rights and go to this music festival and you're charged with domestic terrorism anyway. It requires solidarity against an overwhelming onslaught of police repression, and that's something that's really hard to do. But here the police, despite how much the police talk about protesting the right or wrong way, when they're defining protesting the wrong way as being from out of state and policing the right way as shooting unarmed civilians and making arrests at random, the Know Your Rights framework kind of goes out the window and has to be about solidarity.
Well, I just want to end by saying that I really appreciated the emphasis of the headline that Truthout put on your March piece, which was, Atlanta's Stop City Movement is spreading despite rampant state repression. In other words, it's scary, very scary what's happening, but we do recognize that they're amping up because we're amping up, and so it isn't the time to falter. And I really just appreciated the idea that this is still happening. You know, folks are scared, and they should be scared, and yet they're doing it anyway. And the more we stand together, the less scared we need to be.
Yes, it's been really inspiring to see activists who continue to undertake this fight, who are willing to fight these cases in court, who are willing to look for where Cop City analogs are occurring in their local spaces. Like, there's people beginning to protest in Pittsburgh. There's people who are beginning to say everywhere is Cop City and looking at the effects of police militarization in communities. And I think what Cop City has done, despite all the repression, is giving people a sense of, like, how to fight this and that they can fight this. And for that, it's really important.
We've been speaking with Cody Bloomfield, Communications Director at Defending Rights and Dissent. They're online at rightsanddissent.org. And you can find their piece, Atlanta's Stop Cop City Movement is Spreading Despite Rampant State Repression, at truthout.org. Cody Bloomfield, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find both shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter Extra, about our Action Alert Network, or to show support for the show, if you're able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer and Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Well, we'll take a short musical break as we hook up on the telephone with John Grant in outside, just outside Philadelphia.
Everybody can believe that it's you. And it lives, and it on, where in the bird of paradise. Everything seems wrong somehow. Oh, baby, you're nobody's sweetheart now.
How's it going? What's the weather like? It's beautiful here. It's just a sunny day. It's in the like mid-80s. Beautiful day. Just watered all my tomatoes. They're coming along. They're finally really growing fast. So, really nice day.
That's good. Yeah. Same here. We've had several days like that. It's getting up to 76 degrees right now. No wind and lots of sunlight,
right,
which I like. So.
Yeah, so it's good. Yeah.
Well, it's all good except for McCarthy and Biden and the showdown over the debt ceiling. What does
Go ahead.
Well, I just haven't checked the time. The New York Times. I haven't checked the Times lately. What is it?
There's nothing on it today. I don't know why. I was in over the weekend. I was in Manhattan for a wedding, so I was actually in New York and not reading the New York Times. So, McCarthy. You look at McCarthy. You know, and you look at his history and how, you know, he got to be Speaker of the House and he had to completely sell himself out to, Jim, what's his name, the wrestling coach and all that the far right Congress people.
Jim Jordan.
So his only power is to hold out. His only power is to hold out and scare the country and, you know, Ms. Yellen says that if we don't raise the limit, the country's going to go bankrupt and the country will turn into Donald Trump Incorporated and refuse to pay people and things like that. Donald Trump was famous for mooching on people, not paying people. So, in other words, his only power base is to hold on to that to the very, very last minute. And so what Biden is doing is talking to him, but also coming up with all these, bells and whistles sort of questionably legal, questionably constitutional sort of avenues to do it anyway. You know, like one of I heard was for the mint to manufacture a $1 trillion coin, and then they could spend it, and they'd fill the hole or something. And there's the 14th Amendment. There's a couple others. So I think the way it's always been in the past when, they always held out to the very last minute, and so they'll hold out to the last minute, and they will do some cutbacks, I imagine, to get this thing done. But in the end, I think it's probably going to be done. And if it's not, I'm of the school that we can start playing like the Republicans, and he can do his 14th Amendment, his $1 trillion coin or whatever, and do it that way. And, everybody says, oh, my God, that's tyrannical, that's illegal and all this. Well, hey, join the crowd. This is what you smack-assed that are doing over there in Republicans. So I'll do it, and we'll send it all the way to the Supreme Court, and then it's on Clarence Thomas and all those bozos to decide, this is illegal. The country has to go bankrupt. No, they're not going to do that. They're going to do a Bush v. Gore and rubber stamp some, Rube Goldberg variation of the law and move on. So I don't know. I think a lot of it's theater. But we'll wait and see. I don't know. I certainly don't know.
No, I think it is theater. It causes anxiety levels to high. At least 325 million people in this country, 170 million directly or indirectly receive some sort of government help, either it's Social Security, food stamps, all kinds of things. And not all
yours,
of them.
Yours truly.
Not all of veteran VA hospital benefits, all that stuff.
I'm a total advocate of American socialism with the Social Security and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely.
I agree.
Most old people are dedicated socialists in that respect. Yeah.
They just don't want to admit it. They're closet socialists.
Or even the MAGA gang, the old goat MAGAs, don't touch my Social Security. That's American, man. Come on.
What was that Tea Party sign that became famous? something about, you know, stop big government, keep your hands off my Medicare, something like that.
Exactly.
Like that.
There you go. Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
I hate communism and socialism, but don't touch my Social Security.
So I think it is all someone said it's a game of chicken, you know, but then you got a callback at the end. I don't know if it is.
Yeah.
I don't think they're gonna. But and they do. This is another. I don't know. Is this a conservative way of reminding us that we're spending too much? Washington Journal on C-SPAN this morning. When we get in periods like this, I'll listen to this. Get up early in the morning, turn on C-SPAN, listen to the callers, and the callers are they're terrible. It's a horrible, horrible reflection of America that calls in Washington Journal on C-SPAN in the morning at 6 in the morning out here. And I'm like going,
my
gosh, what idiot will get on the phone? One after another. But I was struck. I always sort of keep the smarter ones. There was a half dozen that were articulate, but of those half dozen, two in the first hour advocated cutting back the military defense, the so-called defense budget.
This is the theme these days.
I mean, it's not. Have you seen it on corporate media? Have you seen anybody talking about shutting down 800 military bases?
Well, elements on the right see it as a because of the Ukraine war and all of the NATO issues, and of course Donald Trump made an effort of going over and pissing all over NATO and insulting them and all that. And as I say, I've watched on Tucker Carlson, he's gone at the moment, but, you know, I watched this sort of recruiting on the right to, for strange bedfellows of people on the left. I mean, the left is, anti-war left is just completely bereft of power. They've been kicked to the curb. I mean, we're all anti-war activists, you know, we're all licking our wounds these days, you know, and so very powerless, if you will, and you got the right doing civil war in America, and then you got the Biden people doing very expensive international war in Ukraine. So this is a moment of war is on the table. Which war do you want? You know, and the peace movement is pretty much powerless. So some elements on the peace movement are looking around for, you know, little places of power that they can snuggle up in and advocate for their consistent message of lowering the defense budget and not having foreign wars. You know, so I think that's going to play a strange bedfellow element in the upcoming 2024 election, but we'll see. This is going to be a very strange election, I feel. You know, you got Tim Scott running. You know, he's running kind of the left of Trump and DeSantis. Tim Scott, the black senator from South Carolina. You know, the Clarence Thomas effect or whatever, having a right wing. A Republican black president would be a novelty. So as I say, it's going to be a real circus. So we'll buckle up.
Well, I think there's a plausible reason to cut back the defense budget. It's obvious it's almost 50% of the national budget itself.
Absolutely.
And it's failed. It is a fact that it's failed at least the last five, maybe six audits, courtesy of thiscan'tbehappening.net, which broke the story, courtesy of Dave Lindorf and a partner of his. I mean, and they failed. The Pentagon failed an audit years ago, and that story broke. And then, of course, everybody stole it from Lindorf and his partner on that article, and it went around and had legs. You know, it traveled so far.
Well,
people didn't credit.
Dave was right on. You know, Dave pointed out, frankly, you know, a theme that you know, it wasn't Dave's original idea, but Dave is a real snoop boy. He digs this stuff out, and he got all the information. It's a great story. And notably, on that exact same theme, you know, going from Dave Lindorf, great radical Dave, and is this can't be happening, well, was it Sunday night? 60 Minutes did this incredible expose of the Pentagon and how they are scamming and fleecing taxpayers, and that the taxpayers and the government does not have one thing they can do about it, because the five big defense contractors own the plans. They own the plans as a private enterprise for all these death-dealing weapons that we have, and they're fancier and fancier and scarier they're getting. Well, the government does not own these, and so they can charge whatever the hell they want, and the government is forced to pay it. So, you know, you get the dynamic of, you know, something is worth $1 million, and they charge $10 million for it. And so they're just rolling in the money. And the point of 60 Minutes was, you know, it's outrageous, but it's legal, and there's no way around it because, you know, unless, you know, you get, a president of the United States that will nationalize, you know, Grumman Aircraft and all these other McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and all these, you know. You nationalize them, you know, which the Chinese would do, and private corporate capitalism does not own the plans for the death rays that are coming, you know. But there we are. There it is. You know, that's the problem. Because, you know, we can have all the Dave Lindorf stories and all the 60 Minutes stories, you know, coming from, you know, all different directions in the political spectrum. But there's, you know, it's not illegal. It's not illegal what they're doing, you know.
Yeah. Well, not being audited. I mean, even a conservative would want to audit this was put out 5 years ago, and I'm going to play a part of it.
Get full episodes of the Damage Report as a podcast on iTunes and Android, and you can watch the live show every weekday on YouTube TV. So what the hell is going on at the Pentagon? Recent report in The Nation, amazing accounting fraud going on. Literally billions, trillions of dollars, seemingly unaccounted for, perhaps unaccountable. Let's try to make some sense of it. We've got Dave Lindorf joining us, both investigative reporter, longtime contributor to The Nation, who wrote up that report. Dave, welcome to the show. Dave, thank you again for joining us on the Damage Report. Very excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So, look, your report was amazing, very widely spread. You're talking basically about the Pentagon undergoing an audit, and it looks like it went about as poorly as it could have. Is that a valid interpretation?
It was a total failure. The only thing that they accounted properly was the retirement fund.
So, what are the numbers that we're talking about here?
Well, I mean, first of all, there was a study by a professor at Michigan State University, Mark Skidmore, who specializes in public agency accounting. And he went through all the reports that were done on parts of the Pentagon budget over the course of 1998 to 2015, and he found $21 trillion in entries on the liability and asset side of the Pentagon's financial documents that could not be accounted for, couldn't be, backed up by any kind of ledgers. And they basically render the budgets completely useless for any purpose at all.
Yeah, and it's certainly consequential when it comes to deciding how much Congress should give the military, which we'll return to. But that $21 trillion number, obviously that's a big draw to attention. I mean, that's more than the military was budgeted over that time. Now we don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, we don't think that they've actually lost $21 trillion, but potentially a significant portion of that could actually be money that, you know, went, you know, into the dark. Maybe somebody has it. Maybe it was spent on something. I mean, the numbers are still significant, even if not $21 trillion.
Well, as Professor Skidmore points out, you can't really know anything about it because the Pentagon won't tell us anything about it. What I've been told from my sources for the article, which included people who have worked for years in the Pentagon, people who've retired and are speaking on the record, like Jack Armstrong, who was supervising the audits by the Pentagon's Office of Inspector General for 5 years, ending in 2011. Chuck Spinney, who is a celebrated whistleblower who worked in the Pentagon and did his reports with his name attached back in the 80s, exposing epic scandals and fraud. All these people have told me that it appears that what the Pentagon's doing is making up the numbers and trying to paralyze Congress and the media.
Making up the numbers. You can't.
I think it is that bad, John Grant.
I really do think
it's agree
bad.
It's that bad. And as I say, it's so bad that goddamn 60 Minutes, the most establishment CBS News show that you could ever imagine, is doing the same goddamn story yesterday on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the absurdity of the world we live in, you know. The 60 Minutes is basically, you know, in the overarching larger sense of it, doing the same story that Dave's doing. But 60 Minutes' point is, well, you know, this is controlled by capitalist corporate America, and there's nothing the government can do about it. Now, that's a different angle, but it's the same absurd, frustrating, terrible situation that we're all bemoaning on the left and the anti-war left. You know, we've been bemoaning that for 40, 50 years. And now 60 Minutes tells, well, keep bemoaning it because, the corporations own it. And, of course, I'm now watching the final, next to final episode, and that last one's next Sunday, of Succession, which is about, you know, corporate family-owned, you know, a fictional Murdoch empire, you know. And it takes place in New York, of course, and it just shows you this insulated, powerful, billionaire-saturated world of decisions that are made completely remote from the American public, the quote people, whatever that means, and it's right there. And I was, of course, in Manhattan for a wedding with my family, and we were, my brother, who has tons of money, was squiring us around in these Ubers, and the Ubers in New York are, you know, have a whole fleet of SUVs, these Chevy Suburbans, these monster beasts, you know, they're the same. In fact, I was riding around in the thing in a seat, the exact same seat in one of those. I was riding, I rode from four times from Amman, Jordan to Baghdad and back, you know, in 12 hours. So I'm riding in this thing in the streets of New York in Manhattan at night, you know, and having flashbacks of, you know, driving crazy through Iraq and these, you know, so this is the world we live in, the security emphasized world. You know, we're riding around in these big black cars, you know, that you see in the president and the secretary of state's entourage, you know. I mean, this is the crazy world we're living in. And as 60 Minutes points out, the corporations basically own it, you know, and here we are. I don't know. It's a pretty gloomy analysis, I know, but Hello? Mike? Mike?
Yeah. I was listening. I didn't know if I'd
lost you. I'm sorry.
Well, I was trying to wonder why I left you just for a second to dump out. I was trying. You're riding around in high security black limousines in New York, in Manhattan, and I'm like going.
Well,
why,
as they say, it's. Go ahead. No, why what?
Were you riding that way in Iraq, in the Middle East, when you were traveling over there?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. The Suburban, the Chevy Suburban or GMC Suburban, these huge, heavy-duty SUVs, monsters with huge tires. They are the vehicle of art that goes between Amman, Jordan, and or at least when I was there in 2001 or 2003, from, you know, A to B there through the deserts. You know, we were doing 115 miles an hour through Fallujah in that thing. You know, the guy's going, Alibaba, 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 you know. And it's the same vehicle you see for security purposes. I'm sure they're super up-armed for the president and people like that. You know, they probably have walls, you know, made of 10-inch steel or something. But, you know, these are Ubers, but and we had six people, and you know, you get six people, you need a big vehicle. So we were, you know, riding around. The Grant family decided as a jape, as a hoot, we'd all go visit the Grant's tomb, right? Ulysses S. Grant was a very popular ex-president, ex-general when he died. He had 1.5 million people at his funeral in New York, and they built up along the Pacific, or the Hudson, they built Grant's tomb. It's the largest tomb you could ever possibly imagine. It's not a memorial. It's not Lincoln Memorial where they have a statue. They just simply have his casket and his wife's casket, and it's just a monster. And, you know, it has fascists surrounding it and all this. And it used to be a big drug hangout when Grant's star sort of fell, and this huge, humongous, absurd tomb along the Hudson became a hangout for heroin addicts and people like that, you know. And they cleaned it up about 20 years ago, so now it's a park. But I don't know how. That's a little digression, I guess. But anyway, we took one of those black SUVs to there, and we were running around at night going places. And I don't know. It just struck me as absurd. As I say, I'm in this thing. And then I come home and I watch Succession with all these billionaires running around in the same damn cars, you know. And it all came together, all this drama, and I realized I had a vision of America. We're all riding around in up-armored SUVs, you know, with gun ports and stuff.
That's probably a vision.
It was a rather hysterical vision.
We're all fucking – well, I got news for you. I got most Hicks out here.
Right.
I got two cars in my yard that I can't keep – running, you know, there and
right.
They're just like junk. I got neighbors that drive down off the beaten path, and they've got rusting trucks out in the front yard that they can't.
There you go, man.
Too old to run.
You probably got your old washing machines in the yard too, you know.
Well, I don't, but I have an air conditioner laid out here.
Well, I know that urban look. You know, you throw your appliance out in the yard and you let it rust.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I got an old washing machine.
I'm saying this is Manhattan is the ultimate urban place.
Yeah.
Ultimate. And so for people in Kansas, the urban world to many of them is like the enemy. It's hell, you know. It's compacted humanity. Well, you don't get it any more compacted than New York City, you know.
Yeah, but
Manhattan.
Did you really see anybody outside? inside that fucking black Suburban.
Well, that's the thing. You don't get to see anybody riding around in this armored vehicle, you know, and you look out the window and, you know, I'm looking out the window and with my my sister-in-laws and in the car. There was five of them. You know, I was the only male in the car with my wife and whatnot. And so I was getting a little punchy, as I say. I'm feeling a flashback of driving through Iraq, you know, and I'm looking out the window and we're passing the Museum of Ice Cream, and then a block later it's the Museum of Sex, and I'm going like, what the hell, you think they're affiliated, you know, what the, you know, this is New York. So it was a wonderful trip, a wonderful wedding, my cousin's daughter, and I hadn't been in New York in probably 15 years, and I love to visit New York, but God, I wouldn't want to live there. Whew, it's a monster. It's just a beast.
We're going through this occasion with you. How far was it from Manhattan to Grant's Tomb?
Well, I guess it's about a half-hour drive. And, of course, there's a little traffic, but it wasn't that bad. But, you know, it gets up along in the bluff, I guess, overlooking the Hudson at that point. Just below the George Washington Bridge, which is kind of the north part of New York. You know, on the bluff overlooking the Hudson, just south of the George Washington Bridge, is this big, I mean, really clunky-looking thing. It's a monster, you know, and it even has, Roman fasces around the top. You know, I explained to my brother and his wife what a fasces was. You know, the fasces is, of course, the symbol from the Roman magistrate of a battle axe surrounded by sticks tied with a string and rope. And it's a symbol of the magistrates when they were conquering people. Somebody would lead with this fasces on a pole. Well, there's two of them. Every time you hear the State of the Union message, next time you hear it, look to the left and the right of the president speaking at the podium. On the wall are two extraordinarily beautiful fasces made out of brass. And fasces, of course, is what the socialist journalist at the time, Benito Mussolini, who became, a tyrant, dictator, how he came up to coin the term fascism. From this Roman device called a fasces. And, of course, two magnificent examples of them straddle the podium at the House of Representatives in Washington. Well, they're also around the top of Grant's tomb. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, like a dozen fasces around the top of the dome. And I'm explaining this to my brother and his wife and going, what? What's a fasces? Oh, yeah, okay, well, there's fascist symbols all over American government, Elaine, you know, don't you realize that? No.
On the bluff.
Anyway, I had a good weekend with my family, you know.
On the bluff of the Hudson River, correct?
Yeah, it's on a bluff overlooking the Hudson River. Grant's tomb.
Well, you know, if I had an SUV, an armored, up-armored, as you call it,
right,
and I had my family, and I had my in-laws in it, okay, and other people.
Uh-huh.
I would take them up to where Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton on the bluff.
Oh, that's
of
an
the
idea.
Hudson River.
Next time we'll look that one up. Yeah, right.
There's no tomb or nothing. It's just a little plaque on the ground on top.
Is it
of the
okay?
Yeah, there's just a plaque. Okay. There might be a very, very small stone.
Sure.
Or blessed or something like that. But it's very overlooked. I'm sure there's many junkies that ran up built there.
Exactly. A good junkie spot there, you know, where Burl took out Hamilton.
Yeah, right. to me, that's where I want to go if I ever go there. To me,
okay.
To the bluff.
Well, you would, you know, my wife and I looked at it as a jape or a hoot. You know, my friend used to call them japes.
Well,
you know? And you would have enjoyed it. We would have had a great time, you know, drinking, of course, and riding in these big black SUVs through New York.
Oh, God.
feeling like the billionaires in the drama Succession, you know, looking out at all the plebs and the peasants, you know.
I guess I'll have to look at it. I'll have to watch that. I haven't seen it. I don't know. I've heard it's a soap opera,
but it's a high-toned Shakespearean soap opera. Let's put it that way. About power in America. It's brilliant. It's very brilliant. You know, but I've watched it all, so I'm totally saturated with the drama and the characters and the three successors of the father who just died two episodes ago, and now they're all fighting amongst themselves in the power suites. And there's a Swedish billionaire who wants to buy the company, and you know, and he's squiring the sister around, and so they're all fighting amongst themselves. And you know, next week is the final showdown. We're going to decide who the successor of you know, the Papa Murdoch sort of fictional character is. It's a total indulgence, but it's very good. Yeah.
Out here, we just get afternoons on PBS with Downton Abbey. That's the closest we come. 19th, early 20th century British aristocracy. I mean, that's about all we get out
of course.
Here. So this trip was interesting in that sense, and I agree.
It was.
Manhattan is on the very end of the peninsula, for lack of better terms to describe New York City.
Well, yeah, technically, I guess there's islands and rivers separating them. There's Brooklyn, Bronx, and all that kind of stuff. Then there's Long Island. Long Island, of course, then extends up towards Connecticut, out of the city. But Manhattan, of course, is the center city, Midtown, and all that.
Okay.
You know, you got uptown, downtown. The avenues between First, you know, and Broadway's an avenue. There are major north and south avenues in Manhattan, and so traffic can be a nightmare. And of course, we learned the difference between yellow cab and Uber, and there's a big battle between the yellow cab and Uber because, you know, Uber is the hip thing. You don't pay any money. It's all done on the iPhone, and there's no tipping. The tipping is done before you even get in the car. And so there's no incentive for the driver to take the slow lane or circle around. You know, with a cab, though, this guy taking us to the hotel, it's a long story, but he stayed in the slow lane. There were two lanes on the far left that were zipping along, but he took three lights because our hotel was on the right instead of taking the fast lane on the left and letting us walk across the street at the red light, you know. Would have saved us $5. We hadn't had to wait in that slow traffic. But, you know, he took the stop and go slow traffic just so he could watch the thing click or click and keep going up. And you don't get that with an Uber because it's all a done deal before you even get in the car. anyway, this is the space age modern world. I had a blast. I photographed the wedding. It was a great wedding at the Houston Hall across from the Film Forum, which is a famous repertory cinema theater in Soho. So it was a very hip place. My cousin must have spent $30,000 on this thing. He's I don't know what the heck he does. He lives in Jersey.
You get a lot more.
The Sopranos.
You get a lot more for $30,000 up there than you do here. I've known some people have spent $30,000 on their daughter's weddings out here. It's nothing like that. Absolutely nothing like that. Absolutely.
Well, this was great. You know, this is a wonderful place. This is a normal bar. You know, it's just a wonderful. Apparently, at one point, it was a FBI warehouse, and God knows what else it was. But just a wonderful, rich, historic kind of venue. And oh God, all the—I mean, I have this vision of the young people dancing. You know, my cousin's daughter, a beautiful young woman, is married a guy from Taiwan who's into cryptocurrencies, a financial wizard apparently. And I'm going like, oh, my God, look at all this. And all these really slick and hip young people. I have this vision of this very, you know, hot, tall, young woman, very attractive woman in a short dress. And she's got a drink in one hand and her iPhone, which is lit, in another. And she is dancing hard as can be all by herself. And I don't know if she's dancing somebody on the iPhone, but, you know, I heard Elon Musk talk about the Internet and all that as the extension of the human nervous system into infinity, right, which is an amazing idea when you imagine it that way. Well, here she was. She wasn't dancing with anybody, apparently dancing with anybody at the show, at the party, at the wedding. I don't know what she was dancing with. She was dancing with, like, the Internet world, you know. She had a drink in one hand and her iPhone in the other. And I'm going, like, wow, welcome to the new world, you know. It's like, dum-de-dum-dum. So I had a blast. I had a blast, yeah.
That's,
you know, I always feel like a rube with a straw in my mouth when I go to New York.
Right.
Manhattan.
Well,
like, oh my
Kansas.
God, look at this.
Well, now you know how Kansas, people in Kansas feel.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, no, I appreciate that. You know,
sort of a room just watching.
Yeah, let's come in, let's watch a show, you know.
Yeah. Look at all.
And
the
of course, the first thing
here.
The first thing anybody from Kansas coming out of the train station would meet is the guy that I met. We come out, and there's a taxi line with 40 people waiting for cabs. And I'm going, Gwen, what the hell are we doing here? What are we supposed to do to get a cab? It's like, you know, God, you know, or should we just walk? And suddenly this black dude, big black dude, comes up, and he can see we're rubes from the hinterlands. And he says, here, can I help you? And I says, well, I'm looking for a cab. I don't know the etiquette. He said, come on with me. Follow me. I says, okay. He said, follow me. And so he's taking me a block and a half back so that the taxi line, we're getting the cabs before they get to this huge taxi line. And he's figured that out, and he's starting to scam me. I can see it. You know, he said, here, give me $17 to where you want to go. How do you know that? Well, that's what it is. And so, you know, he says, I'll pay the driver. So I give him a 20. And I guess the driver didn't want to do that. So he gives me the 20 back. And he says, now just give me a couple of bucks for what I did. And I did. I gave him $3. And the guy got me the cab. But, you know, you could see the guy. He was ready to scam. He was ready to take my 20 and a book, you know. But, you know, I was on him. And I think he decided, well, I don't want to. This guy is pretty reasonable. I'm not going to scam him. But you could see it. You could see the mind working there, you know, of all this humanity piled upon each other, you know. You know, it's like, you know, you got to make a living somehow. So you fleece whoever you can. You know? And that's how
that's
we get
crazy.
Donald Trump. The Donald Trump is at the top of the heap in Manhattan, you know. Am I right or what?
Well, there's no doubt that he would want more than $3.
I know there's a few shortcuts in my analysis there, but
he's trying to. Well, he probably wanted. If Donald Trump wanted a cab, he goes, I want more than $3 to get a cab for Donald Trump.
Right. Oh yeah.
That's a.
Oh, yeah. Donald would have tipped him a little better. Donald would have tipped
Donnie
him a little better. Yeah.
Well, Donnie's so poor, I mean...
Or else
you
would have
welched
on completely. I thought one of the
other. Right. Or try to...
You know, all those people who did jobs for Donald Trump and his businesses, and Donald Trump, I don't like those fucking guys. I'm not going to pay them.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's his modus operandi. That's how he gets through. Well,
really?
I was just laughing. Someday he'll be poor enough, he'll have to do that. Hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, I doubt it, but maybe, you know. It's a long way from Mar-a-Lago to the streets of Lower Manhattan.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a different world. It's a different world. Of course, the irony is, of course, New York, you know, and all of its darkness and horrors and all that is a very liberal city, you know, compared to Florida, for God's sakes, you know. You know, Florida is like, you know, all of my relatives are in Florida, so I was restraining myself from talking about Ron DeSantis because, you know, I was told not to stir up the politics in the family. You know?
Oh, were they up there? Were that your Florida relatives up there too, in Manhattan?
Oh yeah, my brother from Florida. His daughter, his son, and their families were there. And it was like a grand bonanza there. I tell you.
I couldn't have restrained myself. Florida. I mean, my God, what's the latest from Florida? I mean, my God, what's the latest outrage? You know, Latino truck driver.
Well, in my family, the latest outrage is Lori, my beloved. What was she? My niece, who is a first grade teacher. Has been a first grade teacher for like 20 years plus. Just resigned. Because she can't stand it. She, you know, the way they're censoring and restricting and burning books and not all this. I mean, she just said, you know, she had 6 years to go for her retirement, and she said, "Screw it, I'm quitting." So she has to wait 6 years, and she will pick up her retirement. But, you know, it's just, I mean, my niece Lori is a very, very good first grade teacher. You know. Her mother was, and yet she's run out because, you know, she's a reasonable, honest, open-minded human being, and they don't want them teaching people in Florida now. You know, it's pretty serious, actually. It's not a funny thing, but anyway, it's happening, and this is why I tell everybody, including all my Florida relatives, that wait and see. Wait and see. Ron DeSantis is going to turn out to be the coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons. You know, he runs over the cliff and he's hanging in midair, and all of a sudden he looks wide-eyed at you and he goes, the equivalent of the famous last words, he goes, "Oh, shit." And then falls like a rock, and there's little poof at the bottom of the canyon.
Right.
Anyway,
He doesn't seem to be doing very well yet against Trump. And
well, today's paper says he's being very smart, and he's preaching to old people about Social Security. So he knows that. You know, he does have an overextension problem. So he's now backed away from the edge of the cliff, and he's now preaching, "Oh, yes, I want to save your Social Security, all you know, white-shoed, white-belted old goats in Orlando and places, you know. I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry yourselves, you know." It's only, you know, the other people, the radicals and the queers and the black people, you know, those are the ones that we want to, you know, oppress and control, but not you old people. We love you old people here, you know.
We're going to run all these other people out of Florida.
Right, exactly. Well, the NAACP and gay groups and another one have encouraging tourists to boycott the state of Florida.
Yeah, right.
In other words, if you're black, don't go to Florida, you know, go somewhere else. If you're gay, can you imagine all the gay people in Florida? I mean, it must be crawling with gay people.
Especially down in Tampa,
it's beautiful,
Miami.
Everybody can wear bathing suits and look good, you know.
Miami and Tampa, legendary gay places.
Well,
Miami,
of course, Key West is the you know, hanging out to dry place for gay people down there in the water. At some point he can't sustain this. Certainly, when he has to go far, far right against Trump in the primary. Well, you know, then you got it. Then you got to back up, and you got to run in the main election. That's where, you know, hopefully, you know, he'll die, but who knows?
So is this? Are you referring to earlier? You're referring to Tim Scott. Who is that? I don't know anything about that guy.
I'm sorry, who?
Tim Scott. I think the guy that announced.
Oh, Tim Scott. He's announced for president. He's a big, tall, black dude. He's been a senator, probably reelected once, to South Carolina. He's along with Lindsey Graham. He's the other senator from South Carolina, where my brother lives in Charleston. And he's, you know, he's running for president. And, you know, he's very conservative. And, you know, I don't know if he's as crooked as Clarence Thomas, but he's, you know, sort of a Clarence Thomas figure of sorts, I would suppose, you know. But he's much younger and fresher and, you know, doesn't have the baggage of course, Clarence Thomas, who's becoming quite a novelty of corruption, it seems to me.
A novelty of corruption, I guess.
Well, I think he's pretty unique. I mean, I don't know. It's like, how do you get away with getting a $500 million vacation bribe?
Well,
I don't know. I mean, you should.
He claims he'd rather just be in his Winnebago, camping out in his RV in a Walmart parking lot. That's what he.
Yeah, right. I'm sure that's what he does.
Well, that's what he said on 60 Minutes.
Well, I would imagine he's not that stupid because, you know, if he starts running around the country with his wife and in a big SUV and the wrong person notices, oh, my God, it's Clarence Thomas, you know.
He
probably has an entourage of security with him wherever he goes.
Well, maybe, but he has.
If I were him, I would, you know.
He had either a PBS or a 60 Minutes camera crew. I've seen it. Him driving around.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is over 12 years ago when it's on available.
Right,
on YouTube,
I think when he was younger they did that. Yeah.
I mean,
where he's so controversial now, I don't think he could be caught in public. You know,
well, he was,
that would be.
Well, honestly, he was controversial. He's been controversial since he found a pubic hair on his Coca-Cola can when he was a lowly federal employee.
Well, you and I both know that. I agree. Right.
This guy.
But you know,
know
that corruption has aged like a good brandy or something, and it's real snappy and, you know, condensed and rich, and it's just, you know, he's established, he's confident, he knows he can get away with murder, and, you know, he just does it.
A lot of money.
This is the world we live in.
You're in Manhattan. It's not the world I live in, but it's in Manhattan.
No.
You were up there among those kind of people. I mean, amazing. Billionaires and millionaires.
I did, and as I say, it was a real jape. I thoroughly enjoyed myself, you know, seeing how the other half live, I guess, or the other 10%, you know. The penthouses on the, you know, the 144th floor, that's where they are, you know. And, you know, they get around by helicopter. They don't have to walk around the streets like you and I. But.
I thought that's how they do it in Brazil. I watched a documentary on Brazil. That's how the rich people get over. They fly on helicopters from the top of skyscrapers.
Yeah, you plop from the top of one building to the top of the other. Yeah.
But, yeah, seriously, before Clarence met Harlan Crowe, you know, Donald Trump and, you know, gets everybody out here cussing George Soros.
Mm-hmm.
George
Soros. Wow. He is it. Yeah.
People have got to be seen through this. Don't you think? I mean, I think people are
beginning to realize
we're all fucked. I mean, you just go down the street, go down the gravel road, drive your junk vehicle, if you can get it running, and go down the road and see your neighbor and tell them. I said, don't you think these people are, the rich people are screwing us? And I'll bet you 3 out of 4 will go, hell yeah, they're screwing us. Three out of four would say that.
And so what do they say? Yeah, they're screwing us. Let's vote for Donald Trump, right? What? You know, Donald Trump's going to liberate you from corporate greed in a way.
I think that was such a disappointing 4 years for them. I don't think they'll know what to do. And I think a lot of young people are back in the point where they don't even want to vote. Biden is just a great disappointment to them, you know. Student loans.
Well, I've run into it. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I've run into this generational thing now. I mean, it's kind of what you're leading into in a way, is young people are so frustrated. You know, they blame, you know, people tend to blame the person closest to them, you know. I mean, the easiest one to blame. And so I found this in Vets for Peace. I even found it in This Can't Be Happening, that, suddenly it's my fault, you know. I'm doing it, you know, because I'm a white man, and, I sound like a conservative, but I have encountered this, you know. It's like, I don't want to hear any ideas from you because you're a white male and you're an imperialist and your people have destroyed the world. I'm going like, right, I've been saying that for 40 years, right. I'm a self-hating wasp, you're right, you know.
But suddenly,
I'm not a self-hating wasp, I am the problem. Well, some people, you know, I don't want to be too hysterical on this, but I think young people are really, really upset and screwed and, you know, scared of the world they find themselves in. And who made this world for them? The older people. Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. Being angry and being frustrated isn't a solution, you know.
Well, putting everybody, I'm not talking about the 1,253 billionaires in the world. I'm talking about everybody else that's over 40 years of age in prison penniless.
Right. I mean, well, don't trust anybody over 30. Remember that
30,
one. That 30. Was us.
I mean,
that was our generation.
But here's the thing. That trust is different than, you know, in my opinion, I really do think a lot of young people just as soon see us all dead, frankly. And
eventually, they know that's going to happen, and then they're on their own.
I mean, it really becomes this kind of thing of extremist, Gerba. What do you call it? Hubris. It's like hubris of the generation.
Hubris.
And,
indeed. Oh, yeah, hubris. Hubris is like arrogance squared, you know. It's like much, much more powerful arrogance. Hubris.
And I don't see that. I don't see that among many of the old people. I see, even on, I point out, I said, well, look here, you know, look at the, go to Netflix, go to YouTube, or especially the larger corporations. They're bringing women, lesbians, gay men, you know, they're in Star Wars. Today, what was the, Cannes Film Festival in France, you know, a woman director is nominated for. And she's the director of this movie about that, what's his name, Johnny Depp stars in, you know, about King Louis of France. I see a lot of contradictions there. I was like, I mean, they're making a movie about a guy who gets his head cut off, and and he's played by one of their darlings that they grew up with, the younger people. What's his name, Pharaoh on the Pirates of the Caribbean. And so it's like, I think it to me, and it's done by a woman director. Here the news is, well, this is most women directors at the Cannes Film Festival. 30% of all the films are directed
there
by
you go.
Women.
And this is why we have a white male backlash, because everybody other than white males is beginning to rise to the top, you know. And white males are saying, wait a goddamn minute, we're supposed to be in charge.
No, I don't see a backlash. I see most men just back off and say, please. I've said that to my wife many times. Please do it. I don't want to.
Well, you don't think the MAGA backlash is – okay.
No, I don't think –
okay, it's a semantic thing. We can – backlash.
I don't think there is a MAGA backlash. Really, I don't. I mean, I think that it's withering and getting so weak by the day.
Well, geez, I hope you're right. Absolutely, yeah.
I don't see it happening. I mean, we're a year and a half out, from 2000.
Well, you see, this is all part of what I see, this overarching idea of a third Reconstruction. The first Reconstruction was pushed by President Ulysses S. Grant, whose tomb I just went to. And, of course, that effort of Reconstruction in the South failed because of the rise of the KKK as a militant, death-dealing, lynching organization. So that backlash destroyed the first Reconstruction. Well, then there was the civil rights movement, and then you had the backlash there, the hard hat movements and all these kinds of things. And ultimately we had Ronald Reagan, and that failed. But each advance something. Well, now we're in the third one. This is, I think, a third Reconstruction. And you and I are part of it, and we're all part of it here. And, the MAGA backlash and Trump backlash is also part of it, the Proud Boys and white supremacists and the overtness of racism these days. It's to me classic Reconstruction and backlash. But that's a larger sort of movement in society.
I think that's real. I think most of the old people right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to make sure they get their goddamn Social Security check without any problems.
Oh,
that's all.
First priority, absolutely. Cover my ass, man. Yeah, absolutely.
Please, young people, go get a job and keep the place running. Keep the place running.
Amen,
John
brother.
Grant.
You got it. Amen.
John Grant, folks.
Hey, Mike Cadell. Take care, my man.